on this special International Women's Day edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
My mother was an activist. She was on the ground. That's where she excelled. She was very good at organizing rallies, talking to people, and put a crowd in trance with her speech. And she really was talented on that.
We spend the hour with writer and documentarian Yves Blouin, daughter of André Blouin, Congolese political activist, anti-colonial leader, and women's rights advocate.
She rallied 45,000 women, and women had absolutely no rights. I mean, they were like even more than second-class citizens, you see.
Yves' mother, André Blouin, once called the most dangerous woman in Africa, played a leading role in the struggles for decolonization that shook the continent in the 1950s and 60s.
I hope you share with me the conviction that good will eventually win against evil and that the countries of the Great Lakes region of Africa will rise and shine again one day as they deserve.
And Rwandan political prisoner Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza addresses the Women's International Network for Democracy and Peace on the struggle for democracy and human rights in Rwanda and an end to Rwanda's war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Today, we celebrate One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, envisioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. André Blouin was a Congolese political activist, anti-colonial leader, and women's rights advocate. Born in 1921 in what is now the Central African Republic to a French father and an African mother, she was raised in a Catholic orphanage where she was denied connection to her African heritage. Blouin became a prominent figure in the fight against colonialism, particularly in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where she was a close advisor to Congolese Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba. As the director of the women's wing of his party, she mobilized grassroots support and was one of the few women involved at high levels in African liberation politics. Following Lumumba's assassination in 1961, Blouin was forced into exile, but she continued her advocacy for decolonization and women's rights internationally. She later wrote her autobiography, My Country, Africa, the autobiography of the Black Passionaria, detailing her experiences in the independence struggles. André Blouin's daughter, Yves Blouin, spoke to Block Report's J.R. Valray.
Well, your mom was a leading figure in the Pan-African movement. Can you talk a little bit about her upbringing as she talks about in her new book, My Country, Africa? Can you talk about her upbringing and what led her to getting involved in the freedom fight?
Well, she was born in 1921. And 1921 in Africa, I mean, she was born literally in the country of the heart of darkness of Conrad, you know. So it's exactly where she was born, which is the Republic of Central Africa, as we call it today. But back then it was called Ubangi-Shari. So she was born in 1921. Her mother was a tribes girl. She was 14 years old. And her father was a merchant, a French guy. And they had my mother. So as it was extremely remote, people have to understand that in 1921 Africa, there was literally nothing. It's not the way Africa looks today. You would have those cities, for example, Brazzaville or Bangui, which is the capital of Ubangi. It was like literally a few houses, not even an hospital, but it was like an infirmary, a post office, and a few shops. That was it. And surrounded by the jungle and the immensity of Africa, which is so huge that people don't even realize that you can put China, America, Europe, India, et cetera, in this country.
So I know that the the death of your brother led to your mother's politicization. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that led her into that African movement?
Well, she then grew up in this place that was like an orphanage, an institution for mixed race children, because they did not exist back then, you see. And therefore, she pursued her life being, a seamstress. And then she had my sister from out of wedlock. Then she, the guy disappeared, and then she married this man, and she had a son with him, and the child fell very sick. The local administrator who didn't want her to have the quinine, you know, the medicine for her son, because he was a quarter black, and he died. So that was the catalyst of her anger and revolt that she felt because of that. And of course, a lot of people are asking, but was it legal? Was it normal? No, it was not legal at all.
What was not legal?
The fact of not allowing a child to have this treatment.
And where was this?
This was in Ubangi. But it was, you see, it's hard to understand. Those guys, they would have complete power. They would do everything they wanted, even though it was against the law, you see. So this man was probably an extremely rabid racist, and therefore refused the treatment for my little brother. And my mother, of course, she was so devastated that it created in her this anger that led to her political definition and option.
So how did it move from there to from this grief and this pain and this devastation to her working directly with the leading?
It took a few years, you see. She was like brewing at the time. And then she met my father, who was also a Frenchman. But my dad was extremely humanist, had no idea about the colonies. He arrived from France. He was working there. It was a different, completely different background for him. There was no such thing as racism in his bones ever. So then they got married, and they moved to Guinea. And Guinea at the time, compared to Ubangi, which was the Central Africa, in Guinea, it was very politicized. The decolonization process was on its way. So people were very conscious about getting away from France. And that's when my mother got involved. And that's when she met Sékou Touré. And that's when my parents met Kwame Nkrumah. And that's when the whole thing started, really. It was...
Well, what was her position in her relationship with Sékou Touré? Because I believe she worked for his government, right?
My mother was an activist. My mother was, she was on the ground. That's where she excelled. She was very good at organizing rallies, talking to people, and put a crowd in trance with her speech. And she really was talented on that. And that's what Sékou Touré asked her to do. She was working for the RDA, which was his movement. And she was rallying and touring Guinea and making the people vote against France, against the rule of France. And that's how she started. And then, of course, Sékou Touré introduced her to all her friends. You know, they were a group of people with, including Nkrumah, who was his best friend. And Touré really gave her the tools to begin her political career.
When you say he gave her the tools, you mean the political connections, or are you saying the political knowledge, or what do you mean?
Knowledge she already had, because actually, funny enough, let's say that she was trained by my dad, who was very liberal, you see, And he acquainted her with all these books at the time that you, when you want to, when you do activism, you want to read, you see. So that was one thing. But Touré, on the other hand, introduced her to the people who were doing their job in terms of decolonization at the time.
So did she go country to country, or was she just stationed in Guinea with Sékou Touré when she worked with Nkrumah and Lumumba?
Well, what happened is that she started in Guinea. Then Guinea became independent. So while she was in Guinea, one day they went to a restaurant. You see, life is funny sometimes, you see, just when things are aligned, they are aligned. So it was definitely meant to happen. She goes to the restaurant with my dad, and she hears a group of guys next to them talking Lingala, which is the language of Congo and Central Africa. So nobody talks that language at all in Guinea, you see. So she hears them talking that language. So she was very curious, and she goes to see them, and she says, "Well, I'm sorry, I just heard you talking Lingala. Are you from Congo?" And they say, "Yes." So then they start talking, and then she realizes that they were the activists from the Congo that... you know, that came to Guinea, invited by Sékou Touré to train and get together in order to carry on the independence in the Congo. So then they asked her, because they knew of her talent at rallying people and all that, they asked her if she could come and help in the Congo, because, you know, they needed help. So then Touré he interfered. He said, you know, they talked to him and they said, "You think we can borrow André and ask her to come and help with the rallies in the Congo?" And he said, "Absolutely, she will help you, and she's going to organize your activism over there." And that's how she went to the Congo. And that's how she started this extraordinary job that she did over there, rallying. I mean, she rallied 45,000 women, and women had absolutely no rights. I mean, they were like even more than second-class citizens, you see. So it was extraordinary. I mean, what she did in the Congo was extraordinary. And then she met Lumumba, you know. She was working with the Gizenga. She was working for the PSA at the time, which is the Parti Solidaire Africain, with Gizenga. And she was like the big sister of all these guys, because they were young, you know. They were like 30 years old, and she was already 40. So she was like a big sister. She had a sort of ascendant on them. So they had to obey, if you see what I mean. She was, you know, she was quite formidable, and she had this natural authority about her that made her people would listen to her. So then she met Lumumba,
Patrice Lumumba, right?
Patrice Lumumba, yeah, and he named her his chief of protocol. And so she was in charge of, you know, the organization and everything. So then she rallied everybody for him, you see. So he won the elections, and he was named the prime minister. So what she did was actually unbelievable, particularly for women back in those days, you know.
So she was with the Pan-African Revolution when it was going into the OAU, and they were seeing whether they were going to federalize or whether they were going to go in the slow motion that people like Nyerere wanted, which was opposed to the Nkrumah, Sékou Touré, Touré faction. Where did she stand, and how did she move in that arena?
Well, She was based in Guinea. We were living in Guinea. We went to Leopoldville with my dad when all these, you know, all these madness was happening. That's when we met with, for example, with Juliana Lumumba, who is Lumumba's daughter, and until today, I mean, she's like my sister. We still speak on the phone, and we lived there for a small amount of time, but the rest of the time we were based in Guinea, and this is where everything was happening, you see. It was between Accra, Conakry. Leopoldville was in complete turmoil, as you know, and all these organization and everything was happening. It was letters, phone calls. It was very remote, Africa, at the time, you see. I mean, the communication was very difficult. But she was indispensable to all these movements because of her capacity to rally people, and particularly to rally women to the cause, you see. So
what kind of issues did she deal with organizing women?
Well, the problem was, in, for example, it's a funny thing, you see. It's very sad, because the women were, I mean, they were so completely, I mean, they were treated like slaves, literally. They had no rights. They were owned by their family, who could marry them in exchange of money. And they couldn't say anything. They had no rights whatsoever. And on top of that, there was a big problem of alcoholism and prostitution, because to make ends meet, they had to do something. And, you know, it was hard. It was really hard. So she managed to make, you know, the self-esteem of these girls were so low that when they threw themselves into the decolonization and the revolution, there was a huge breath of fresh air for them. And that's where exactly out of these weaknesses, she made something colossal. So these women became the most revolutionary, even more than guys, you see, because of all the possibilities that the revolution would give them.
You're listening to the voice of writer and documentarian Yves Blouin speaking to J.R. Valray on this special International Women's Day edition of Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We'll be back after this short break.
To fight for my yearnings. Fear in my mind is a warning. Pray to the one you're relying. I've been wandering all day. I tried to be fine, but I can't be. The noise in my mind wouldn't leave me. I tried to get by, but I'm burning. I'm behind my mind.
That was Thames, Free Mind. You're listening to a special International Women's Day edition of Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We're celebrating one heart, one fight, one sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. André Blouin, once called the most dangerous woman in Africa, played a leading role in the struggles for decolonization that shook the continent in the 1950s and 60s, advising the post-colonial leaders of Algeria, both Congos, Ivory Coast, Mali, Guinea, and Ghana. Her autobiography is titled My Country, Africa, Autobiography of the Black Passionaria. Here is more from Block Report Radio's J.R. Valray in conversation with André Blouin's daughter, writer and documentarian Eve Blouin.
So what was you guys' life like when first Kwame Nkrumah got overthrown and then he was installed as a co-president in Guinea? How was that? And were you guys there when that was happening?
No, we were not there. We were not there because what happened is that when Lumumba was killed, they put, how do you call that? You know, when you have to, a bounty, they put a bounty on mother. So she had to disappear. And they put my dad and my brother in jail, and me and my grandmother, mommy's mother, who was this Central African woman, in a jail somewhere with Mobutu's soldiers. You know, I mean, it was dramatic. It was really bad. So then we've managed to regroup with the help of some activist friends. Our family managed to regroup after that. We went to Switzerland. We went back to Europe. We couldn't stay in Africa anymore because we literally were persona non grata. So we went to Switzerland and we stayed there because the son of the General Guizan, who is the only general that Switzerland ever had, believe it or not, was a big fan of Lumumba. So he gave us a flat where we could stay, and we stayed there with his help because we had no money, we had absolutely nothing. So we stayed in Switzerland because we couldn't go back to France because of political views, obviously. And the only place that allowed us to stay was Switzerland. And then my dad found a job in Paris, and eventually he was going back and forth between Switzerland and Paris. And then after that, we left Switzerland and we went to Algiers. That was the mecca of all the revolutionaries at the time, you know. And that was in 1964. We arrived in Algiers. We took the boat from Marseille and we arrived in Algiers. Algeria was freshly independent. And then the government took us in. They gave a job to my father, and my mother continued her activism from there.
When you guys were in exile, your mother was still doing activism, or did she have to just lay low?
She never stopped, no. And for example, the life in Algeria was very fertile in terms of politics and activism, because the whole, Algeria at the time was really the mecca of all the revolutionaries, all of them. I mean, they would allow those guys to come and stay, they would pay for the apartments, they would give them money. It was extraordinary what this country has done for Africa and for the militants of the at the time. You had like Amilcar Cabral. I mean, even the Black Panther were there, you know? And so of course, when you have this kind of cauldron bubbling with all these ideas and aims for Pan-Africanism and the unity of Africa. So yes, it was very productive and very active.
So what was it like when a lot of the leaders start getting assassinated, dying, all of the original leaders of the Pan-African Revolution, Nassar, Bembele, when all of them started falling off? What was you guys' life like?
Well, you know, it was very banal. We had a family life. She was a mother. She was a housewife. And there was no, microwave oven or any. I mean, it was very basic at the time, you know. But she was always very active in writings and organizing these things. You see, these reunions and conclaves and all that. She was. She would hear from the newspaper what was going on, and of course, at home, our flat in Algiers was like, I mean, it was full of people. There were reunions every day. It was like the Pan-African chamber for a better world. So there were always some guys coming, and they would talk endlessly of changing the world, changing Africa, and the unity of Africa. My brother and I, we were doing our homework with this in the background, and the kitchen was busy because there was always some food for those guys. And she was very African. There was always somebody coming and going, and always a stew with rice and beer, and that's the way it was happening, really. And then you would have the lots of reunions organized by the government, the Algerian government, and of course the parties at the African embassies of Algiers. So that was the big event, because there was nothing else to do. So they would meet there and talk endlessly about changing the world. It was fantastic. The 70s in Africa, it was unbelievable. Everything was, I mean, they were like fresh, full of determination and hopes, and everything was possible. It was fantastic.
So how did your mom start to document her life? Was this something that she did towards the end of her life, or was she keeping papers all the way, or how?
She started when we were in Switzerland, and then something happened there. So she had all these, all these files, all these documents, and she already had started drafting the story of her life. And then one day, she was approached by some journalists from Italy, and they said that they wanted to write an article about her. And basically, they said, look, if you have a script, a manuscript, we can help you with this. And she was, I mean, even though she was revolutionary and everything, and she was quite, she was very wise, on the other hand, she was extremely naive, because she would trust anyone. So she gave them her manuscript, they tweaked it and published it. And then somebody told her, but your book is out. And she could not believe it. They did it without her consent. And the book was called Mi chiamavano la passionaria nera, meaning they called me the black passionaria. That was the title of the book. So she sued them, and she won, and the book was destroyed. So that was first story. Then,
what year was that?
That was in 1963, just after the death of Patrice Lumumba. And it was after the death of Patrice. So then after that, she continued amassing some notes and writings, and she was doing all other stuff as well. She was writing articles for the El Mujahideen, which is the newspaper of the revolution in Algiers. And she was very active, and she kept on writing speeches. That was her forte. She was very good at that, for diplomats, for revolutionaries who needed a speech for tonight's reunion, or a rally in a stadium, Mohammed number five, or, it was, that's the way it was happening, her writing. And then she went to New York. We went together with my brother and my mother and I. And there she met Rosa Guy, a writer in New York, who was French. She was a Michaud bookshop in Harlem. So Rosa Guy, she was this black American writer, and she introduced her to her friends, who were in the publishing business. And they signed a contract. They wanted to publish her. But then She met somebody who was introduced to her by a guy from Angola, and it was his girlfriend, I think. And they became friends, and she said, look, I can write, I can publish your book, I can do something about it. And then she decided to go with her and this person. I don't know what happened, you know, they, she, you know, people always try to get something out of a situation. So then the second book was published in 1983, My Country, Africa. And then my mother died. Then this woman died a few years later, and the book was not published anymore. So it took me decades to be able to recoup the rights of this book, because it just disappeared. I had no idea where, how to get it and how to get the rights back legally, you know, to do the right thing. And finally, I was able to do so. And now the book is published again. But it took me all this time.
So when the book's name is My Country, Africa, Memoirs of a Black Passionaria, right?
That's right, yeah.
What does that mean? What is a Black Passionaria?
La Passionaria is, it's a Spanish word. It means a woman of passion. Like passion, you know, passionaria. And in fact, it was coined, the word passionaria was coined by an anarchist activist female. I think it was in the 20s, or yeah, maybe between 1910 and 1920. I can't tell you exactly the dates. But this woman was called Dolores Ibaruri. And Dolores Ibaruri, she was like, she was enormous. She was in the milieu, in the Spanish politics. She was the queen, the empress of the anarchist movement at the time. And when she would go on stage and talk to people, you could hear a fly. She would just suck the attention and the souls of the people listening to her. So mommy was like that. She, my mother was very, she really had a talent. She knew how to speak to people on stage. And that's why they called her the Black Passionaria, because she was just like Dolores Ibaruri, the anarchist. They had the same kind of talent. And that's how her name, why she was called the Passionaria as well.
Was your mother, I mean, I've studied a lot about the Pan-African revolutions of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and there's not a lot of women that went between the countries that we know about. Is her story an extraordinary story? And is she one of very few? And I want to know that, or is it just that they're not being documented like that?
I think it's a bit of both. It's very difficult to find documentation about those these times, you know, particularly in Africa. And also, there were no women at all, almost, in the world of politics in Africa. It was a male thing, you know, a woman. Oh, no. She had no room, no place in this arena. But mother was one of the few who managed to do so.
Why do you think, besides her politics, because she had to be exceptionally very intellectual and have great politics to be among the leading people, but why? Because I'm sure that even some of the revolutionary leaders had chauvinistic ways. Why did she have a spot when there were no other spots? Why did they pick her to be the Pan-African stateswoman between Bembela and Lumumba and Nkrumah and Sekou Touré? Why her?
Because of her talent to rally people together. That was it. She was extraordinary. I could tell, I mean, we were there. You know, it was happening at home. My dad was puff his pipe and cigar. and listening and taking part of the conversation, but the rallying, the breath of passion and resolution, it was my mother all the time. And because she was, and she had this, she was powerful. She had this power. She was not afraid of anything at all. So she had this kind of assurance, you know, though she would get into a room and immediately inspire sort of respect. That's the kind of personality that she had. And I think that's why they chose her, because in fact there was no other woman to be able to do that. You know, the African woman at the time, she was at home making food, cooking fufu and doing, you know, and looking after the kids.
You're listening to a special International Women's Day edition of Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We're celebrating one heart, one fight, one sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. I'm your host, Polina Vasiliev. André Blouin, once called the most dangerous woman in Africa, played a leading role in the struggles for decolonization that shook the continent in the 1950s and 60s, advising the post-colonial leaders of Algeria, both Congos, Ivory Coast, Mali, Guinea, and Ghana. Her autobiography is titled My Country, Africa, Autobiography of the Black Passionaria. Here's more from Block Report Radio's J.R. Valray in conversation with André Blouin's daughter, writer and documentarian Eve Blouin.
You put this book out at such an extraordinary time in history again, where the African independence movement 2.0 or 3.0 seems to be underway. You have the Sahel Alliance. You have a number of countries breaking free from Mayotte to all the way to Botswana, Ghana. How do you feel as somebody who's resurrecting your mother's legacy and putting this book out at such a tumultuous time, but at such a good time to some extent for Africa? And how do you see this time today in the revolutionary movements of today in Africa?
Well, I can tell you, if she was alive, she would not like at all what is happening in Africa. In fact, she didn't want to live anymore. She died of cancer. She stopped her medication when she heard, when, you know, she every day there was somebody coming from Africa and telling her news of this, of that, the papers, what she would see on TV, read in the newspapers, etc. And she was so upset. Her dream was shattered, because you have to understand, back then, those guys, they were romantics. They were absolutely out of touch with reality and cynicism and all this. You know, they wanted it. For them, it was this marvelous, glorious dream of a free Africa, unite Africa, and suddenly look at Africa today. Look at what is going on. Look at all the wars. And, you know, it's, I know she would be extremely, extremely sad to see her country, Africa, the way it is now. And she didn't want to leave anymore. So I was watching, I was there, I saw. And she refused her medication, and then she died. She was 65. She was young, you know. So putting her book out now, I think, is a good thing, because it's the testimony of an ancient. It's like a great grandmother talking to her great grandchildren of stuff that had happened back then, and hopefully is going to give them an idea and enough space to meditate about what has happened back in the days, and how to change the world and make it a better place, you see. But the division and the wars, and particularly in the Congo, as you know, with the Cold War never stopped. It's still happening. You still have these blocs who want to get the resources from all these places in Africa. You have the worst for Mami was the corruption of the Africans themselves. She wrote in her book, she said that she realized with bitterness that the worst enemy of Africa was not the West or the East or the whites or this or that. She said that the worst enemies of Africa were the Africans themselves. And in fact, she was already pointing the level of corruption and lack of real political determination that the rulers of many countries in Africa lack, you see. So that for her was le coup de grâce, you know. When she saw that, she said, that's it, I have to go.
What do you as her daughter want for world leaders that read this book, people who have national or any kind of power in within their state government or their national governments? What do you want them to get from this book?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that, you know, having been brought up in politics all my life and having gone through all the dramas and tragedies that have happened when I was young, me, my sister who passed away, and my brother, and my grandmother who actually was killed in front of me, you know, she was beaten by the soldiers of Mobutu. Anyway, so I think what I wish those rulers and everybody, in fact, it's not even rulers, who cares about them? It's the people in general. I think politics is good, but it's also bad. I think we have to, enough of violence, enough of division. It's just about getting down to earth and enjoy the company of each other. You know, it's very simple. What I'm saying seems to be completely idiotic somehow, but it's not. If only people would have, you know, respect for each other and good dispositions for each other, things would be just fine, because, you know, the human beings is very simple. As long as the family can raise their children decently and feed them and have a roof above their heads and a job, things are okay. But with all the political problems and the robberies and the corruption and the world, the way the world is ruled right now, it's not happening. The poverty and the desperation of people around the world is staggering. What I would wish for people is just to respect their sovereignty, you know, for the rulers to respect other countries' sovereignty and work in synergy. That would be great. But I don't know if it's going to happen ever.
With all of the different freedom movements in Africa today, where would you think your mom would be standing today in Africa? Say she wasn't sick, say she was young, and where would she be standing in Africa today in Africa's politics? Would she be even involved in Africa's politics?
She would definitely be she was and still would be a Pan-Africanist. That's what she was. She saw Africa as a big country. For her, going from the Congo to Ubangi, to Guinea, to Algeria, Ivory Coast, Madagascar, Mauritania and everything, it did not make a difference. It was Africa, you see. But her love for Africa didn't mean that she didn't appreciate and love Europe as well, you see. And this is a very subtle way of looking at it, because it was expanding even more her vision of Pan-Africanism. Because one thing that people don't talk about enough is the fact that, you know, when you talk about Pan-Africanism, you think that they're all black. Not at all. You would have like Algerians. I mean, I know that they're not considered completely white. I'm lost. I don't know what it is, really, this black and white thing, you know. But you would have Algerians, you would have French people. It was like a worldwide sort of nebula, you know. And that was the beauty of it. It was that human species together, hand in hand. And what started it? The Pan-Africanism. It went beyond Africa. It was extraordinary. When you think, for example, that when Algeria became independent, the GPRA with a GPRA, was the government before they had the revolution, okay? It was the previous, I forgot the word in English.
The colonial government, right?
Not colonial, not the provisoire. Provisoire means in between two, you know, it was before the revolution, the Algerian government, they already had their cell of guys who were going to rule the world, and they already had their little army of, not army, but soldiers, fighters, training in countries like Tunisia. And you had guys like Frantz Fanon. I don't know if you heard about Frantz Fanon. Frantz Fanon was
Wretched of the Earth, of course.
Right? He was in Algeria, and he was representing the Algerians. And Frantz Fanon, he was, you know, he was a guy from the Caribbeans. So that's the spirit that I'm trying to explain, the spirit of Pan-Africanism. It was beyond the boundaries of Africa. It was almost stellar, you know? And I think that if mommy was alive today, she would be there. She would be in this, you know, this kind of heights of politics where all these mediocre fights and arguments, she did not have time for that. So I think that's where she would stand. Definitely.
We keep throwing, I know what the word Pan-Africanism means, and I know you do, but how would you define your mother's definition of Pan-Africanism?
Her definition of Pan-Africanism was, for her, there was no boundaries. And I think that the way she was seeing Pan-Africanism had a lot to do with what we call, I don't know if it is the same meaning in English, but in French it's called humanisme, you know, where it's the human being above it all. And this humanisme, you can be from anywhere, you are a human being, and that's what matters. I think that's the way she would look at it, and that's the way she was looking at it as well.
That was writer and documentarian Yves Blouin speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio about her mother, Andre Blouin. Blouin's autobiography, titled My Country, Africa, Autobiography of the Black Passionaria, is out now from Verso Books.
بكبر تطرتو بكبر يدا ساولي نور ساوموتو يتسطنيوت زاري بنطانت ساو تكفلو بتال كدمنا كاتنت سنتو اغان ودقان ከፊታችሁ ዛሬ በኩራት በክብር በደስታ በፍቅር
That was Gigi Adwa. You're listening to a special International Women's Day edition of Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We're celebrating one heart, one fight, one sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza is a Rwandan opposition leader, democracy activist, and vocal critic of Rwandan President Paul Kagame's government. Born in 1968, she lived in exile in the Netherlands for years before returning to Rwanda in 2010 to run for president against Kagame. She was never allowed to register her political party and was eventually arrested, then sentenced to 15 years in prison on charges of genocide denial and political organizing to oppose the government. The African Court of Human and People's Rights ruled that the charges were unjust and ordered the government of Rwanda to pay her restitution, but the court has no enforcement mechanism. Ingabire advocates political pluralism, human rights, and reconciliation in Rwanda, and an end to Rwanda's war in the neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo. In response to international pressure, she was released from prison in 2018, but she is banned from running for political office or leaving the country. Nine members of her political party are now on trial for possessing a book about civil disobedience. In 2019, Victoire Ingabire addressed the Women's International Network for Democracy and Peace on the struggle for truth about the Rwandan genocide and the folly of using Rwanda's tragedy as an excuse for the West's so-called humanitarian interventions.
Mesdames, Mesdemoiselles et Messieurs, bonsoir. Je remercie le Réseau international des femmes pour la démocratie et la paix qui m'a invité à assister.
Good evening, everybody. My thanks to the International Women's Network for Democracy and Peace, who invited me to participate in this evening. I thank them again for their brilliant idea of creating this award to be granted to anyone who peacefully militates for peace and democracy in the countries of the African Great Lakes region. I thank all members of the jury for the prize, for their availability, and their impeccable work. Specifically, I ask you to help me applaud Mrs. Roger Biloa, Mr. Juan Guerrero, and Mrs. Therese Baloji. Since I have been involved in the political struggle for the democratization of my country and the stability of the countries in the African Great Lakes region, I have witnessed Mrs. Roger Biloa fighting like a lioness to ensure that the world gets the real picture of violent conflict in the African Great Lakes region. I was quite pleased to read the letter that Juan Guerrero wrote to Paul Rusesabagina's daughter, where he denounced some human rights organizations which wear double hats. On one side, they denounce human rights violations, and on the other, campaign for war in Syria or Libya, or even distort the truth of the crimes committed in the countries of the Great Lakes region. I thank all laureates who are fighting for the reign of justice and democracy in the Great Lakes region of Africa. Recently, I published a document titled, How Rwanda Can Maximize Its Potential in the Region. In my humble opinion, I described three steps that must be taken to stabilize and develop countries of this region. First, the countries of the Great Lakes region must be democratized. Democracy is about more than holding elections. In a democracy, minority voices are heard and they are respected. Opposition candidates present their political programs to the electorate without threat or intimidation, and the freedom of expression and the freedom of press are protected. The people of the countries of the Great Lakes region of Africa need to participate actively in the decisions and definition of policies that affect them. Secondly, we must approach an end to the impunity which has been exercised in the countries of the Great Lakes for decades. In this regard, I congratulate the Congolese people who are campaigning today for an international tribunal to prosecute crimes in DRC. And finally, the last step, there needs to be a transparent approach to economic interests in the region. For example, the people of the DRC must be the first beneficiaries of their resources by doing clean business with the other people in the region and the rest of the world in a win-win position. However, security conditions must be met beforehand to ensure a safe environment for any business activity. Today, we live in a world where might is right. The right of the strong prevails. But, as Rousseau has clearly explained, force does not make law. We all know that strength needs the law to hide its weakness and that strength is never strong enough to always be the master. Today, more than ever before, there is a great conflict between good and evil, between trust and lies. However, I hope you share with me the conviction that good will eventually win against evil and that the countries of the Great Lakes region of Africa will rise and shine again one day as they deserve. Thank you.
La bien souriée dans sa lettre. Je vous remercie.
That was Rwandan political prisoner Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza addressing the Women's International Network for Democracy and Peace in 2019 on the need for human rights in Rwanda and peace in the wider African Great Lakes region. The UN Security Council has maintained a UN peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo since 1999. However, it has never succeeded in keeping the peace in the country's eastern provinces bordering Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi, and some say that the ineffective mission's real purpose is managing the war in the interests of the big powers and corporations with resource interests in the region. The current conflict began when Uganda and Rwanda invaded DRC in 1996, then again in 1998. In January 2008, the International Rescue Committee published a study in which they concluded that it had caused more than 5 million casualties between 1998 and 2007 alone. The majority died from displacement and disease, and nearly half were children. There are more than 7 million internally displaced persons, or IDPs, in DRC. There is an International Women's Day march in solidarity with Congolese women, Saturday, March 8th at 1 p.m. at the Rwandan Embassy in Washington, D.C. The demands? Rwandan soldiers must immediately withdraw from the Congo. Don't let our tax dollars fuel the conflict in Congo. Provide humanitarian support. Don't visit Rwanda, and no more aid to Rwanda. For more information, visit friendsofthecongo.org.
Victoire Ingabire, Victoire Ninoire, Victoire Ingabire, Victoire Ninoire, Victoire Ingabire, Victoire Ninoire, Victoire Ingabire. Watubere intwari ingabire twirebera nkabogeza umupira watubere intwari ingabire twirebera nkabogeza umupira.
And that concludes today's special International Women's Day edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from J.R. Valray and Anne Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.